This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to a new year of Radio EcoShock. 2012 promises to be anything but dull.
You know, every major global recession has had oil's fingerprints all over it. And, you know, once again, when we saw triple-digit oil prices, it's not that those triple-digit oil prices couldn't bring new supply, because it will, but, of course, the economy collapsed.
The price of oil hits you at the pump, in your food bill, and everything you buy. What if you can't afford it? For years, I've covered peak oil as the story of a limited resource. Meanwhile, the oil industry, glutted with billions of dollars in profits, keeps drilling deeper offshore, finds more dirty oil in the tar sands, and will risk the fragile Arctic if we let them. Economist Jeff Rubin says we have hit a new kind of peak oil, the peak price our civilization can pay and still grow. We've passed that point now, Rubin says. If China and India grow, Western countries must shrink, and shrinking isn't pretty. Expect unemployment, disappointed dreams, and governments drowning in debt they can never repay. Who is Rubin? He was the chief economist at CIBC World Markets, a global-scale bank trading operation. As a forward thinker on energy issues, Jeff Rubin gets a lot of press and TV appearances. His 2009 book, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, shook up the financial world. He predicts an end to globalization and a return to regional production due to the rising costs of oil. We will hear Jeff Rubin's presentation at ASPO 2011. Then you'll get the main clips from a talk by Charles T. Maxwell. He is the senior energy analyst for Wieden Company. Charlie's been a top-ranked energy authority for years. But neither of these gurus include the challenge and damage of climate change in their forecasts. They don't mention it. Why not? To wrap up that angle, we'll finish off the show with a Radio EcoShock interview with Ugo Bardi. He's a crossbreed. As a founder of Aspo Italy and an editor at the oildrum.com blog, but also as part of the Italian climatologist scene. I'll ask Ugo why these two camps don't talk much to each other. Jeff Rubin, Charlie Maxwell, Ugo Bardi, peak oil, climate change, your coming year, all in this edition of Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Let's get busy. Jeff Rubin was recorded at the 2011 conference of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, or ASPO, in Washington, D.C., on November 4, 2011, by Radio EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams.
Well, thanks very much. I guess our session is called What Does the Post-Peak World Look Like? But before discussing that, I guess we have to define exactly what do we mean by peak. Certainly, my definition of peak is probably very different than the majority of people who are in this room. Peak has traditionally been about production, and I guess some of the problems of getting mainstream to accept the notion of peak is that people have drew lines in the sand before at world production or U.S. production or whatever will be X, and then the oil industry goes X plus Y. Now, some, you know, people will say, hey, that's, you know, it's got a declining energy rate of return. Hey, that's got a different energy density. Hey, that's really not oil in the sense that Hubbard understood oil. But, you know, for someone like me, I don't really care. If you can burn it, it's good enough for me, and probably for most folk as well. So what do I think peak is? You see, I think we set the bar too low when it comes for what our expectations of what the energy industry can provide, because it's all about production. And the energy industry is very good at increasing production. But that's not really the issue. It doesn't matter if there's 170 billion barrels of oil trapped in the Canadian tar sands or in the Orinoco heavy oil belt. What matters is how much of that oil we can afford to burn. And that's a whole other ballgame. Because the energy industry isn't nearly as good as producing fuel that we can afford to burn as opposed to just increasing fuel.
And let's look at where we are today. I mean, oil prices are $100 a barrel if you average WTI and Brent, over 100 if you look at the world price, which is Brent. And guess what? There's a lot of oil flowing. I mean, I'll take the resource that I'm probably the most familiar with because I'm Canadian, and I know about the Canadian tar sands. $20 a barrel, you can't give that stuff away. At $100 a barrel, you know, you're producing 1.5 million barrels a day, probably en route to 3 million barrels a day. At $200 a barrel, you can probably crank out, I don't know, 5 to 6 million barrels a day out of the stuff. But really, that may be of interest to geologists. It's certainly not of interest to me, and it's certainly probably of little interest to consumers of oil, because the question is, at what price? So when I think of peak oil, I don't think of it as a geological phenomenon. I think of it as an economic phenomenon. And the soul of all economics is one word, price. If you can't afford to burn it, it doesn't matter what kind of resources are in the ground. I mean, after all, as Charlie will tell you, that's the difference between a resource and a reserve. I'd say, for all intent and purposes, we're basically at the peak, at my kind of peak, because my peak isn't about production. My peak is about prices and the impact that those prices have on our ability to consume further fuel. In other words, the peak is not how much we can drill, because I think that the supply curve is upward sloping, and whether it's tar sands or oil shale or deep water Arctic, if you give oil companies a high enough oil price, they'll find it. The peak, rather, is not what we can drill, but what we can consume. So the question we got to ask is, does the world economy operate at these prices? And can it operate at the prices that will bring future supply? And I think the empirical record on that is no. It's extremely problematic. I won't repeat last year's speech, but you know, every major global recession has had oil's fingerprints all over it. And you know, once again, when we saw triple-digit oil prices, it's not that those triple-digit oil prices couldn't bring new supply, because it will. But, of course, the economy collapsed. Where do we stand now going forward? Well, we see a world burdened in unprecedented debt. And the key reason the world is unprecedented debt is, how did we get out of the last oil-induced recession? We had a coordinated fiscal stimulus of the type that we have never seen in the post-war period. And not just talking about America, I'm talking about basically every major oil-consuming economy in the world. Well, if you ask your government, or if you ask the government of Greece, or you ask the government of Italy, how they're going to get out of their deficits, they'll tell you they're going to grow their way out of the deficits. Because if you can't grow your way out of deficits, the size of those deficits today, if you have to take direct fiscal action like Greece is having to take, guess what? Your economy is shrinking. The Greek economy shrank 5% for the last 2 years, and it will continue to shrink. And that's the problem. And, of course, in shrinking the economy, you shrink its tax base, and those fiscal austerity measures, instead of improving a country's deficit, actually worsen the deficit, because the impact on tax revenue is far greater than the impact of any expenditure cuts that you might make. So my take on the debt, just like my take on peak may be a little bit different than yours, my take on the debt is a little bit different than maybe what your government thinks, what the European Monetary Union thinks, because, well, all that debt is denominated in dollars or euros, it might as well be denominated in barrels of oil. Because if we're expecting economic growth to be the solution to get the debt GDP level down, to get the deficit GDP level down, we're going to have to be burning a whole lot more oil than we're already burning. Now, already the world economy is burning something like 32 billion barrels a year. And at $100 a barrel, that's $3.2 trillion. I wouldn't deny for a moment that the oil industry couldn't find us more than 32 billion barrels a year, maybe 64 million barrels a year. The only question is, we can't seem to even afford to pay $3.2 trillion for oil. How are we going to pay more? So as I say, all that debt that's denominated in dollars is really denominated in oil. Well, that raises a very interesting question. If we can't grow our way out of these deficits are more or less here to stay, or it's going to take very draconian action to reduce them. And I might say that in this country, you haven't even begun the process of unwinding those fiscal deficits. And the problem, of course, is that unwinding those fiscal deficits result in an economy that is no longer growing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are listening to a speech by former CIBC chief economist Jeff Rubin at the ASPO 2011 Peak Oil and Gas Conference.
So, what does a static economy look like? Because I think what we're looking at is a static economy. Unlike previous oil shocks that were transient price shocks, like the OPEC oil shocks or 91 when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and oil prices doubled, this is not really an oil shock. Nobody's turned off the spigot. In fact, as the oil industry will point out, there's more flowing through it than ever before. It's just that no one can afford the market clearing prices anymore. So, you know, if this is now a permanent state of triple-digit oil prices, and I think it is, because the only time then we saw oil prices collapse is when the world economy collapsed, and that indeed can happen again. But if we cancel out the oscillations of oil-induced recessions and then energy-starved and aborted recoveries, we're basically looking at something that more or less resembles a static economy. That's pretty challenging. You know, one of the speakers yesterday talked about an index of human happiness. I'm not an index of human happiness type of guy, okay? I think static economies generally make people unhappy. And let me just tell you, some of the challenges of a static economy in a developed world, which will be a fraction of the challenges in the developing world. The first thing that you notice when economies don't grow is folk don't have jobs. And that usually registers at the top of the political agenda. Where is the jobless rate going to be in the United States if the U.S. economy stops growing? We could see that even temporary disruptions of growth put the jobless rate double what it was 10 years ago, at 9 to 10%. That's going to be pretty vexing. I suspect the immediate solution will be on closing borders. And, you know, just as my first book talked about triple-digit oil prices resulting in deglobalization because distance costs money and transit costs soon dwarf, in many industries, the wage arbitrage of moving your factories to India and China, I suspect the next issue is closing borders. And, you know, that's a major change, at least in the country that I come from, in this country. I mean, economies like Canada and the U.S. were built on immigration and continue to be built on immigration. I guess our advantage over the developing countries, and a couple of people have asked questions about population, is that we have sub-replacement birth rates, which means that our population's not growing, which certainly takes a lot of pressure off the job creation numbers. However, our populations are growing with immigration, and will we be open to immigration in a closed economy is a very interesting question. What will government look like in the future? I suspect government will look very different than government looks today. Not only is the prospect of further fiscal stimulus out of the question, which begs the question,
In our next oil-induced recession, which the way Brent is going won't be too long, where will the fiscal wherewithal be for coordinated fiscal stimulus in the G7, G8, or G20 when every member country is already hauling debt loads the largest they've been in the post-war period? Obviously, governments will not play the same role in economic stimulation they have in the past, and it really won't matter what part of the ideological spectrum you come from, whether you're a Keynesian interventionist or if you're a monetarist market guy. There just won't be that fiscal option. But above and beyond that, I think that we're going to find that the kind of services that governments will be able to provide are going to be very different when a tax base is not growing. I can give you a couple examples of places where I live, how things are changing. You used to get your license renewal sticker from a transportation ministry where there'd be some civil servant who's getting paid $60,000 a year to give it to you. Now you go into Canadian Tire, which is a big merchandiser in Toronto, and you get the same license sticker from some store clerk on minimum wage. And it's not that I think citizens want to fire public servants, but I think when given the choice between having a government service delivered to you through subcontracting through the private sector and having no government service delivered because it can no longer pay the costs, we're going to choose subcontracting out to the private sector. Not because the private sector is any more efficient than the government sector. I think that's more an ideological position than anything else, but because the private sector can do it a lot cheaper. What will consumer look like? I mean, when you talk about an economy that's basically no longer growing, two-thirds of our economy is consumer spending. If all of a sudden consumer spending stops growing, I mean, that's a whole other world that, you know, I think is very fundamentally different than the world that we've known. What about our trade sectors? I think that what we're going to find is that our economies are going to become much more inward-looking, that trade is going to become increasingly regionalized or balkanized because, as I said in my presentation last year, distance is costing money. And already we're seeing shifts. We're seeing shifts in that, you know, what's driving China's economic growth is no longer exports to Walmart because Walmart sales, if it was, China's economic growth wouldn't be any more impressive than Walmart sales or U.S. consumer spending is. And I guess on that point, I'd like to throw out something that I think is probably very fundamental to the future of this economy here in the United States. You know, we all look at what's happening in Europe, and we all look at the problems of financing a Greece and maybe problems of financing a Spain or financing Italy. Your deficit isn't that much smaller than Greece's as a proportion to your GDP. And while Greece is relying on their allies and their European partners to finance them, and it remains to be seen how long they'll do that, who are you relying on? You're relying on your archenemy. You're relying on the People's Bank of China to finance you. And they're not financing you for the sake of lessening your tax burden. They're financing you because they still think that we're in an expanding world economy where energy is cheap and the U.S. market is the engine for their economic growth. Well, I think in the new world, you're going to find two very important reasons why China will not be financing the U.S. Treasury. First of all, China's most vexing problem, as is India's most vexing problem, is inflation. And if you look at inflation rates are around over 6% in China, pushing up around 10% in India. If you look at what's pushing up those inflation rates, two things, imported food, imported oil. What are those prices denominated in? Those prices are denominated in U.S. dollars. The easiest way that China can put a lid on rising inflation of food and energy prices is to appreciate the yuan against the U.S. dollar.
And if we look at the adjustment between the yen and the U.S. dollar during the 70s, one can easily see as much as a 40 to 50% appreciation. A 40 to 50% appreciation of the Chinese yuan against the U.S. dollar has very different effects on the price of oil in the United States and the price of oil in China, because that move in the exchange rate would dwarf any subsidies that either China or India give to its oil-consuming public. And what does that mean? It means that oil becomes more accessible to the Chinese economy and less accessible to the U.S. economy. And in a world of basically zero-sum growth, in a world where maybe we won't see market clearing oil production much higher than where we are, that's not just basically an inflation problem, that's a growth problem. In other words, the more that China grows, the less the OECD grows. Hence, if oil is driving economic growth, a redistribution in oil consumption results in a redistribution of global growth. So, to conclude, I want to say that, you know, all those ramifications that we think may lie just around the corner once we cross some critical oil production threshold, guess what? We've already crossed that threshold, because the threshold is not production, the threshold is price, and we are now in a world of triple-digit oil. And in that world, all of the economic consequences that we're postulating we have to face in 3 to 4 years, we're already facing. We're in a zero-sum world, which means that if other economies grow because they have greater access to energy, then some other economies must stop growing. Thanks very much.
That was former CIBC chief economist and well-known energy analyst Jeff Rubin. He was recorded at ASPO 2011 in Washington by Radio EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams. My thanks to the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, for permission to broadcast this speech. We move on to one of the heavyweights of the energy investment business, Charles Maxwell. He's the senior energy analyst for Wheat & Company. Charlie is a legend in peak oil circles. Due to time limitations, I've selected two key parts of his presentation. After his talk about when peak oil might strike, Maxwell explains where our future oil might come from. Then I'll deliver his conclusion of austerity and joy. Here is Charles Maxwell, recorded at ASPO 2011 on November 4th.
And Jeff was very good, I thought, on his cost thesis, and I do agree with it completely, just as he said it. But I think that peak oil, I want to come back to this subject of defining peak oil, because I think it's really going to turn out to be quite different than we think it is. I think it's a geologic effect, I think it's a demographic effect, and I think it's a cost effect. And I'm not sure that there aren't going to be a political effect before we're finished. Demographic, because there's simply too many people in the world. We're retreated just to this sensitivity to demographics in the last week or so, because it has been decided by the UN that at the end of this year, this is 7 billion is what we have now. But I think you understand, you've seen these numbers, that to go forward with a billion people, it was something, it took us up to something like 1790 before we had the first billion. And then after that, it was about 100 years before we had the second billion. And now it's less and less and less every billion that we hit. And this last billion was something like 24 years. This is extraordinary. And we are thus increasing our numbers so fast that we don't have a hope of solving the problem of a resource that is finite like this, that we're using a lot of, and that we need to continue to increase using infinitely as our population expands. It just can't be done. It's a non-starter. It's unsustainable. So the issue is not which direction we're going, but simply when we get there. This, I think, is the most interesting chart that I have. It's nothing more than just a look at who has peaked. Russia has to be looked at carefully because the old Soviet Union will not do. And we've subtracted out Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan and all of that, so that the peak of 11.4 does represent the peak of production in what is now Mother Russia. But we're not anywhere near that. I mean, we're at about 10.3, and we're stabilizing out. I think that the top for Russia will be about 10.5. Now, they could go a lot higher. Geologically, they could go a lot higher. But the way they're organized, the way that they're financed, the number of engineers that they can produce, the amount of technological help that they're willing to import from abroad, really tens of factors added together suggests that they're practical peak will be something around 10.5 or 10.6. I think as they approach 11.4, it would get harder and harder. Now, if there were a change of regime, I'd have to change my estimates, because if you said, geologically speaking, Charlie, how high could they go, I would guess 13 or 14 million barrels a day. But just the way that they're organized, it doesn't look like they can. Mexico, of course, is the most dramatic in recent years in terms of its drop, and it is stabilizing. But I think you may understand that this meteor that came in about 64 million years ago hit about 25 miles northwest of the city of Progreso, which is the port for Merida in the Yucatan. And it's still out there, buried deep. And it set off a nuclear winter that we estimate was 5 or 6 years. And that wiped out the food chain. And that killed off something like 80% of the number of species that were then existent in the world. Out of this terrible time of carnage, the mammal assumed dominance of the world from the dinosaurs. It was beautifully depicted in music in Fantasia, that some of you may remember, the death of the dinosaurs. It rubbleized the Yucatan, and you can see that if you go there on vacation. Look for it. It's all over the place. It's the sea bottom brought up here that is the peninsula of the Yucatan. And water, when it rains, goes right down those cracks. And it's that rubble that is out there that is such a good storage for oil. So easy in and easy out turns out to be the particular problem. And it isn't a geological problem that one sees very much. But that storage out there at Cantarell is just a remarkable storehouse, because it is rubbleized rock, which is perfect as a storage for oil. So they now understand why it was such a powerful producer and why now it won't do very much more. So we're back to square one. Mexico can slowly grow if they have an organization that will allow them to do that. They don't, and they won't replace it for political reasons. So they're stuck at about where they are, and they won't be able to help us very much. Norway still has some more. The UK does not have very much more. Argentina still has some more potential growth, but not that much to get back to its old highs. Of these, Colombia looks like it's the only one that will actually be able to, by a political change that's occurring there, the defeat of the guerrilla movement, that they're able to get back to old highs and pass them. Generally, when you go down, you go down for the count.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.